Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Schlossberg with Energy Justice Network. Thanks for making it on this month's National Anti-Biomass Incineration Campaign call. We have calls on the first Thursday of every month, and we discuss a particular topic relevant to biomass energy. We invite guest speakers, and we talk about the issue. And December's call topic is exporting our forests and economy. We'll discuss the economic and environmental impacts of shipping logs, wood pellets, and other forest products overseas from the West and East Coast in the United States. Our guest speakers are Roy Keene, who's a public interest forester and director of Our Forests based in Oregon. We have Greg Pallison, Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, who's also based in Oregon. And we have Rachel Smoker with Biofuel Watch. She's based in Vermont, and the organization is also based in the United Kingdom. Each of our guests will speak for about 5 to 10 minutes apiece, and then we'll have the rest of the call for questions, so please hold your questions until then. And a reminder that we are recording the call so we can pass the audio around to folks. And Samantha with Energy Justice Network will be taking notes. We'll also send that out. So please go ahead and get started. Roy Keene.
Well, during the year 2013, exports have virtually doubled over the preceding years from the Northwest region. And, of course, this is a tally not just of logs going out, but also chips and other pseudo-processed materials. I've talked earlier about this tremendous increase. It's driven by a number of factors. Among the simplest factors are the prices for the materials and the fact that the companies exporting can get tax breaks. And we've got Greg on this call, and he can give some actual examples, details regarding some of these issues. So it's a pleasure to have him here because he's actually hooked into the industry side of this whole phenomena. Anyway, we had a meeting in Newport, Port of Newport, and they're going to pump up the port to facilitate log exports. Now, they've exported logs many times out of Newport, but this is going to be apparently bigger and better. And I'm seeing this trend up and down the coast. They've muscled up the Port of Coos Bay. They're putting some muscle into the Port of Vancouver. They're pumping up these ports to handle larger volumes, not just of logs, but of chips. And whatever follows next, whatever raw products come on the tails of those two immediately evident substances, logs and chips. So we're seeing the muscling up, the preparation that this region is making to be a bigger exporter of raw materials, and we're seeing it in a lot of directions. We're seeing it with the increase in activity on the rail lines. They've been doing a lot of work increasing the trestle strength and muscling up the rail from the Eugene area over to the coast. So all across the board, we're seeing the indicators that there's going to be a great deal more exporting going on. Now, it's important. The one thing I want to bring to people's attention on this call is that the industry will be quick to point out that logs cannot be exported from public lands. But I want to say, under no uncertain terms, that chips can be exported from public forest lands, as can pseudo-processed materials, huge beams and slabs and wood that is designed to be recut and remilled when it arrives at its destination. And this can go all the way down to veneer, which is the raw product that plywood is made from. So there's a lot of veneer getting shipped out. It gets made into plywood in China or somewhere else, and then it gets shipped back to be sold at competitive or more than competitive prices with domestic products. So this phenomena is not only not going away, this phenomena is increasing rapidly. It's not being addressed. Our political defenders are not defending us from this. We're not seeing any real cry from a lot of the different environmental groups. There should be a lot more outrage from the environmental groups locally. There's very little. This is kind of concerning to me because this whole wave of exports is what every nation has experienced in the final stages of forced declination. You're going to have declining forced resources. There's no way to get around it, whether it comes off private or public land. You're going to have a larger demand. You're going to have a draw which is extraneous to your integrity as a nation, and these products are going to go over in raw or less than processed form, and they're going to come back. And I'm going to just pass it out to Greg, because Greg can tell us that not only are we exporting logs and chips, we're not only exporting jobs, we're exporting factories. Anyway, hi, Greg.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
So as an organization, just to give you a little bit of background, I'm an electrician instrument tech. I've worked in the industry, force-related industries, for over 30 years. And obviously have seen a lot of change. And I'm the international vice president of the Pulp and Paper Workers Union, and have been in this position for about 11 years. And so let me, you know, talk about a couple of things. Obviously the jobs impact, and then what happens on the local economies. I will say, as an organization, at certain manufacturing facilities and sites, we do support biomass. And we support it when it's been applied to and it was considered cogeneration. So in other words, there's, you know, the benefit of producing steam, which helps in the manufacturing process, and also produces electricity for either the plant or to sell on the grid. We do have very serious concerns on biomass facilities when they're just standalone, that we think that that's not a good situation. In fact, standalone facilities will put pressure on the availability of chips and raw materials to make paper. And, you know, I think we all know and understand that, you know, industry, it's complex and it's controversial on logging or whatever else. And I do want to preface it also with, you know, I don't know anybody that doesn't use paper products, for instance, and that's primarily what we're in. And, you know, we want the cleanest mills, the best environmental practices and those things done, and we believe those jobs and the laws ought to be very stringent in this country, and manufacturing ought to be from here. So let me give you a quick overview on what has happened in the industry. In the last 15 years, we've really seen an exit of pulp and paper manufacturing, along with, obviously, as you all know, a lot of other manufacturing facilities throughout the United States. At every one of the locations where we represent workers, where there's either been layoffs and or complete plant closures, the employees have been approved for what's called trade adjustment assistance, TAA benefits. And basically what that means is the Department of Labor will do an investigation to see when it's applied for, to see what the cause of job loss is, and to see if it's, you know, imports, or if your employer moved your jobs overseas or the equipment moved overseas. In the last 15 years, everywhere where we have experienced closures, the workforce has been approved for Trade Act benefits, which means it's unfair trade agreements and the offshoring of jobs is the reason for the job loss, not because of a declining market or other things with that. And if you look throughout the country, but you look at, you know, especially a lot of rural areas, you know, when I talk to people, I tell them, forget about the federal government for a minute. Let's look at the states and look at the counties. Most states, a lot of states, are broke on the tax base. And the counties in Oregon, for instance, a lot of counties are facing bankruptcy. And the main reason is the offshoring of our jobs. We've lost the tax base for rural areas. And that has continued to happen for a number of years. And as Roy said, give you an example also of, we've had mill closures. For instance, Weyerhaeuser closed a mill in Longview, Washington. I happened to work at that plant site for a number of years. When they close, they usually do the same thing. They'll cite how the equipment cannot compete on a world market, you know, it's and various reasons on competitiveness, and they closed it. As we all are on the phone right now today, the two big multi-million-dollar paper machines that were located in that facility are in China, producing the very same products that we made here. In Oregon City, and just outside of Portland, Oregon, was a company called Blue Heron Paper Company. They ran 100% recovered waste paper. And virtually all the mills on the West Coast have retooled to run recovered waste paper. And Portland's known as a great recycle city, which is fantastic. And that mill could not compete. The Chinese, no matter what the price of recovered paper was, the Chinese would always outbid U.S. industries, and that company filed bankruptcy. Even though they had orders to run for a full year going forward, they simply could not compete because of this pressure on so much of the offshoring that's happened. And again, for that area, the paper mill was the largest tax producer for the region. And I could, the list goes on. I could go on, for instance, North Bend, Oregon. Weyerhaeuser had a facility there, closed it. That equipment went to Taiwan. International Paper bought a facility in Albany, Oregon, and they closed that facility, and that equipment, again, was sent overseas. And the Blue Heron equipment went over to China also. I'll give you a quick example on the Albany mill. When it closed, International Paper closed a facility in the south on the same day. And the facility in Albany was a profitable mill. And we know that. We represent the workers there. We had profit sharing. The day after International Paper closed the Albany mill and then the Franklin, Virginia mill, they raised the price they were selling container board for, which is cardboard, by 15% on the East Coast and 18% on the West Coast. It's really this just shift of producing a product to countries that have incredibly low wages, hardly any environmental controls at all, and just it's that spiral down that we've all continually heard about. In South America alone, illegal logging is estimated to be $1 billion a year. So, and then with it, and I'll basically end with this, on the log exports, obviously we really oppose log exports, at least the financial, if you look at the economic policies and the trade policies of the United States, we oppose the export of natural gas, coal and our basic raw materials. We ought to be producing products here, as I said, as clean as possible. To me, it's a little hard to believe that over the years we have the fewest number of paper mills, pulp and paper mills, and timber producing manufacturing plants. We have less now than there's been in the last 75 years. And yet the demand is high for products. And so even though we have fewer facilities now, as Roy talked about, our plant sites are struggling to get the raw materials to produce goods because of a lot of it is because of the export of logs off of, as Roy said, it is private lands, and then with the cutback on logging on public lands. So the facilities here that have retooled and tried to meet environmental standards cannot compete.
Well, thanks, Greg and Roy. Open this up now to Rachel Smoker with Biofuel Watch. And whenever you're ready, Rachel.
Hi, everybody. Sorry. I am muted, and I am just about escaping from my family space to get away from dogs that are barking. So if you just give me 1 second.
Absolutely. Yeah, so folks, we'll have our Q&A at the end there, so get your questions ready. I know I already have a couple, and I'm sure Samantha has a few things she might want to add into the mix as well. And we weren't able to have Scott Caranda from Dogwood Alliance. He was going to be on the call, but then wasn't able to make it for a bit more of the Southeastern U.S. perspective, but Rachel will be able to speak to some of that and the exports over to the United Kingdom.
And I'll also speak a little bit to that, too, as well, John.
Oh, something that Scott has wrote back to us, I asked him, it'd be nice to hear more what he learned. He said current projections are 18 million tons at peak from the southeast to Europe, which means a lot of expansion in the southeast of exports. And he said that the industry is starting to come out admitting predominant use of whole trees. Next market to really watch for is Japan and South Korea, where the West Coast could also be implicated. He had just come back from Europe, and you know, talking to people there about exports. That's all.
Yeah,
it's not just the Southeast, too. Right, it's all of the East Coast. But Rachel, are you ready? Bye.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of a little bit of an overview in the IEA's review of the global pellet trade in the space of 4 years between 2006 and 2010, the production of pellets rose from something like 6 to 7 million tons to over 13 million tons, so over 100% across 4 years. And that you know, kind of skyrocketing pace of expansion for the industry is continuing, you know, since 2011, obviously. And you know, it's certainly the case that a lot of that is going to Europe. We tried to look at what some of the other countries that we know of. Japan, you know, shows up as being a huge consumer, and there's certainly a number of different facilities there. It's hard to really get a grasp on how many of these facilities are actually functioning and how many of them are sort of, you know, composed and still pie in the sky. Certainly a lot of the ones in UK have ended up, several of the very large ones have ended up failing. You know, Tilbury has been closed, and the one Ironbridge is also looking like it may end up closing. So I think, you know, the coal conversion plans are kind of more tricky than, you know, than we think, and not always sort of a guaranteed thing. So companies talk about how they're going to do these conversions, but then it doesn't always pan out. But the other thing is, you know, we've been really focused on UK because obviously we work there and we work here in the US, so that's been making a lot of sense. But the, you know, where the UK has had the fastest, you know, rate of growth and is the EU's biggest pellet user in 2012, but still almost three-quarters of the pellets that are going into Europe are going to other countries in Europe. So like in 2012, Denmark is the top importing country for pellets from outside of the EU, followed by UK, Italy, and Netherlands. So we've been very focused on UK, but just the point is, you know, these other, there's other countries in Europe that are actually, you know, more significant in terms of their imports. So the main pellet importers from the United States and specifically were Netherlands, Belgium, and then the UK third of all. Of course, the UK is also importing a lot of their pellets, being the top user. They're importing a lot of their pellets from Canada. So, but from the U.S., it's Netherlands and Belgium are actually importing more from the U.S. than the UK, as far as we can tell. So yeah, the other thing is, in terms of the UK and other European countries, is that the UK government's role in the EU isn't all that strong. In fact, there's been a lot of discussion within UK about leaving the European Union. So their influence over what other European countries end up doing, you know, with respect to renewable energy and other things, of course, is questionable. And they're also, at least according to my colleagues there, they're the least committed to the renewables target by 2020 that the rest of the European Union has taken on. So you know, UK's role in all of this is very significant, but they're not sort of the only player in Europe by any means. And the thing is, unfortunately, there aren't people that are really dedicated to looking at this in the Netherlands, where the plan is to double the amount of biomass co-firing up to 1 gigawatt by 2020, which is a lot. And this is mandatory co-firing requirement with a cap. So that's pretty much what they've decided they're going to do. And they have their own, quote-unquote, sustainability standards that they've developed that you can't read even because you have to pay to read them. and then the other, you know, there's other companies, big companies in like E.ON that are planning to convert big coal power stations, not only in UK, but also Italy, France, and Belgium. So let's see, what else did I want to touch on? If you look at the IEA's Global Wood Pellet Trade Report, which I think was published in like 2011, there's some really, you know, clear figures in there about pellet production and consumption by country. And it's, you know, very clear consumption, for example, in Netherlands and Denmark, UK, Belgium, France, and Sweden, consumption is a lot bigger than production. So they're clearly the countries where a lot of the well, a lot of what they're burning there is imports. And in some of those countries, it's largely coal fire, but there's also a number of those countries where most of the imports are actually being used for CHP and other, you know, heating uses and so on. So I guess I'll just stop there, and I think everybody's got a lot of things to discuss.
Great. Well, thank you, Rachel. Really appreciate that. So, yeah, if folks have any questions, I would say just go ahead and speak up.
I have a question. Hello?
Yep, go for it.
Go.
Okay, this is Loretta, and I have actually three questions. First for Roy, as far as the exports, I live down Mosby Creek, and they're logging for the third time Weyerhaeuser, and they're going at a voracious speed of taking every single tree out. And I'm noticing that Starfire is actually, the yard is filled up with milled lumber. So is that what's happening too? There's some private timber that's actually being productive in the mills here in our mills?
I'm familiar with those operations. There's very little timber left on the industrial forest over 80 years old. Very little. The numbers are remarkably scant. And the problem is with a mill like Starfire that produces high-quality beams and cross arms and planks and so forth, they need timber. They need that fir that's generally 100 years old or more.
Uh-huh.
So they're one of those mills producing high-quality Doug fir products like Oregon did way back when out of older timber, and pretty much in tow with public timber sales. They either have to rely on purchasing public timber sales, for example, off the Elliott Forest where the timber is in that 90 to 130-year-old class. They pretty much have to rely on either purchasing those sales themselves, which is difficult, or purchasing them from the big boys that broker the sales. So Scott Timber or one of the big folks, Superior, somebody who regularly corners and purchases Elliott Forest timber, brokers out a chunk of it to a smaller operation like Starfire. The timber coming off the Weyerhaeuser tree farms, most of that timber coming off their tree farms that's being exported, I would say is probably between 45 to 60 years of age. I would put it in there somewhere.
Uh-huh. You're
talking about
okay.
West Coast timber?
Yeah.
Okay. So also in regards to the Seneca biomass plant and the contract with EWEB, I'm just wondering if there is a way that you can come to, like, the next board meeting, which is the first Tuesday of the month. And they just, I know they're filing a lawsuit with the wind generation with J.P. Morgan Energy Corp because they have a surplus of electricity on on the grid. So they're actually experiencing all kinds of chaotic upheaval of laying people off and wanting to push very strongly towards the smart meter technology and further erode more jobs by automating the system in order to artificially compensate for this excess power that they bought into. And they did the same thing with the biomass, the Seneca biomass contract. They're underwater with that. I was just thinking as a strategy, would it be possible for you to come to the board meeting and address the connection of the issue with the issue with how we're underwater with this biomass, Seneca biomass project in relation to E-Web making a lot of really a lot more risky decisions and going to smart meter technology and laying people off and, you know, the spiraling off of that.
Well, it doesn't do much good to peck at them because they're armored. It's really about getting deeper underneath the process. Really, the most useful thing we could do in Lane County is to have an exchange of commissioners. We'd like to have some commissioners aboard that would take care of us and not be so subservient to Big Timber. That would be good for the rest of us. But that's all just those attendant problems. Biomass is being subsidized in many directions across the board. It's not just Seneca. So
right.
It's a local political problem with Seneca.
It's
local politics.
No, it's actually a multinational problem with honesty. Biomass is never going to be green. It's never going to be sustainable. Never going to be clean. They have this message out. We're fighting against it. We are failing miserably in meeting their claims. And until we get to have an honest discussion on an international basis about biomass energy, we're going to lose. We need to get this into the mainstream.
This is Greg. Can I just in my perspective, like I said, obviously, you know, I think it can be a very complex issue. I think when you talk about biomass,
not that complex.
Well, when I say that, let me give you an example. You know, biomass. There's many different types of biomass and different types of burners. And as I said, I think to take an approach that all biomass is absolutely bad is takes away some credibility. And let me explain that if I can. For instance, when there's biomass that's tied to, I believe that's woody mass that's tied to a manufacturing facility that where they're burning black liquor and doing things. They've been burning black liquor in manufacturing facilities since the 40s. And so when you have a cogeneration plant, it becomes specific on the location and the type of application. When there's a cogeneration plant that you're capturing the steam in a manufacturing process, a new biomass facility comes on that replaces an old boiler that's at a manufacturing plant that's going to continue. That manufacturing plant very well may continue with an old boiler. When you can put in biomass, become much more efficient, you've actually reduced the emissions out of that manufacturing plant and have improved the environment. Now, with that, as I said,
I'm saying that 99%.
Hang on, just if I can for a second, I can get you some facts on it. But you look at the biomass and the woody mass in the United States. In the United States, the U.S. has been growing more fiber each year than it consumes since about the late 40s, early 50s. What ends up happening is when we put such pressure that manufacturing closes here, it shifts to locations that have virtually no environmental controls. China now produces more paper products than anyone in the world and does not have the system set up to do it environmentally as sound and clean as we do here. So to take a position to automatically close things, I think the application needs to be there. Let me just add this if I can. Where there's biomass permits or whatever things going in, we push for clawback language that if it doesn't meet the business needs and or what's there, that if a facility closes, those tax breaks have to be paid back. We also push for and support that before a biomass, if it's woody mass, can go in, there has to be a study to make sure that the wood basket, so to speak, is there and it won't cause other closures or other manufacturing closures. So there's some application where it's good. There's some where it isn't.
Right.
And I think just to take a position automatically isn't that you lose support on it.
Can I continue on with my objection?
Yeah, go ahead, Denny. Go with your response. Sure.
All right. Like virtually all forestry in the U.S. and around the world, or what we call forestry, is non-sustainable. It relies heavily on fracking gas to fertilize the new plantations. They're harvesting plantations way before nutrient equilibrium can kick in, meaning the forest puts back more nutrients into the soil and it's sucking out. Rotations in the southeast have gone from 40 to 50 years when I was planting trees down to 15 to 25 years, which is like way below the 33-year nutrient equilibrium threshold down around here, and we're actually becoming reliant on frackers to grow our forests. And plus, they got to fertilize the hell out of them and pesticide the hell out of them, and it's not a sustainable model.
I think that's a good point. I'm cautioning us from getting into arguing positions since our our network has so much time, you know, ironing out our platform and our positions on biomass, as I'm sure the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers has as well. I want to get us back on track. One question that I want to us to address is the connection between Senator Wyden's forest legislation and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a new trade deal that would open up exports. And do Greg or Roy have anything, or Rachel have anything to say about that?
Yeah, again, is it's a model based on the old NAFTA style, in our opinion. It has more to do with giving corporations sovereign rights or rights over sovereign rights of states and everything else, and it wants really to set up unfettered trade agreements that do away with strong environmental laws and practices, labor stuff and everything else. I mean, as a comparison, you look at the Korea Free Trade Agreement, which was promised to create all kinds of jobs, the trade deficit with the U.S. to Korea, we're now running a bigger deficit. And so we continue to import goods into this country from other countries that end up having a much worse environmental impact on the world than what we do when we produce it here. It's protecting multinational corporations is what it's doing.
Some of the committees that Wyden is a part of, what were they? He's on the natural resources and energy, but is he also involved with the trade committee?
Yeah, he is the chair of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee as well as chair of the International Trade Committee. And so that's the committee that is heavily involved in U.S.
So there's a reason we keep beating up on Wyden. It's because he's in the center
he's
of a lot of
it. He's an export king.
Yes. Yeah. And, exactly.
Don't give him any credit.
I wanted to follow up. This is Roy here. I wanted to follow up on something that Greg said. You know, I look out here in our region in the Northwest. I look at issues kind of like almost like in a triage. Where is the biggest bleed? Where is the most damage? Where is the most potential damage? And I want to second a point that Greg made. There is that biomass burning, which has been going on for decades here in the Northwest, cogen plants. I could name a half a dozen of them. I've looked at them. I've actually done a certification process on the Collins operation, which used a cogen plant. It was very well controlled. It was run entirely from residual products in the manufacturing process. And, you know, in many ways, it was greener than a lot of the options. The problem I've got right now in the Northwest, where the real problem is with this new trade agreement, with these new levers to give tax incentive to ship raw material out and to create subsidies at the other end, at the Asian end, is the current Japanese market, which is shifting the energy market in Japan, rapidly shifting from nuclear power to other options, of which a key option right now is biomass power. So we're talking biomass being generated strictly to generate power to put into the grid. We're not talking about a cogen facility.
That's correct.
We're talking about a country that cannot source or fuel those plants, and guess where those chips are going to come from? Guess why they're muscling up the port of Coos Bay, or why they're muscling up Newport, or why they're muscling up chip facilities at Vancouver? Because there is a full intention. The deals have probably already been cut under these trade agreements. There's a full intention to greatly increase the flow of chips, wood chips, from trees to Japan, to keep their grid running, because people don't want more nukes there. We shouldn't, any of us, want more nukes there. I mean, we're likely to see in the Pacific the end results from the last leak. But anyway, you know, in terms of where the damage is, where the really big bad thing is that's happening, that's kind of where my energies are focused, and that's where I would like to see people in this region focus. Come back, get the little pieces later.
Okay. The big issue is that they present biomass as the salvation for all the other dirty energy we produce. And
yep.
People buy into it. And we are not addressing it adequately to stop this insanity.
Right.
You know?
And messaging is a major part of it. I just recently written an article that makes the point that a lot of what the biomass thermal industry is doing is pretty much advocating for a lot of the same policies, the same, quote, fuel reduction policies,
yeah.
And actually in many cases for electricity generation as well. So industry does try to make that distinction, and clearly there's different levels of efficiency, even though efficiency is sort of an arbitrary concept. So the messaging is that biomass does create pollution and has some environmental impacts. That's what the campaign has been focusing on, absolutely. And
absolutely.
I think that sometimes making that distinction, saying, oh, this is less bad, that is exactly what the industry is trying to make it seem like. And everything, we do know that every time they do a logging job, any time they build a facility, they say, no, this is the green way. This is the sustainable way of doing it. So in my opinion, and other people's opinion, some other folks, that's sort of an arbitrary line of what is good biomass, what is bad biomass. So our campaign is concerned with pointing out the impacts of all of that. And yes, it's probably likely that the smaller facilities will be built rather than the larger facilities. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of the smaller facilities can have some of the same impacts. But I had a question specifically for you, Roy. You had mentioned on another call about wood chip slurry in a pipeline. I don't understand what that is. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Okay, there's been a plan on the board for years, driven by Roseburg Forest Products, to put a 24-inch slurry line from the interior, from basically from the I-5 area, the I-5 corridor, over to Coos Bay, which could carry, and this may be coming more complex now with some of the other products they want to get over to the coast with. This slurry line was going to be designed to carry a kind of a waterborne mix of wood chips through a 2-foot pipe all the way over to the coast, and this was serious business. And whether or not this is back on the board, these things are kept quiet. By the time we hear about these deals are cut.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the Keystone thing. By the time you hear about these deals, mm-hmm. there's a lot of political pantomime that goes on. There's a lot of political shuffling that goes on. There's a lot of booping around. But usually by the time these things get into the media, the deal has been made.
Mm-hmm. So what's the technology of that? The idea of adding wood, I mean, one of the main issues with burning wood is the fact that it has such a high moisture content. So this would be specifically putting wood chips in with water to send them through a pipeline.
Mm-hmm. It would be basically a water slurry mix, yeah.
And then dry them up.
Well, maybe that would be if they do that, maybe that would be a way for the anti-biomass folks to call attention to our concerns, because people definitely resonate with issues surrounding pipelines, so that would be a way to at least...
Oh, they've bought the pipeline at different levels, but there are other plans in the works. You know, there's talk about a new main line, a new highway going straighter over there. I mean, anytime you've got enough timber per acre to pay for some of these fiascos, especially on public land, there's going to be a plan. There's going to be a reason to run to run a swath through the woods.
And the salvage logging thing is a huge one right now.
Yep.
Right. Does anybody know who Dave Sieber is? He's been a hemp activist for over 30 years. He was in the lumber business.
I'm not sure. What's the name again?
His name is Dave Sieber. He's an entrepreneur. He's been very involved with the hemp industry. And he has actually come up with prototypes of building materials that can replace tree materials. And he's approached the mills, and they said bring as much because they can go right from raw hemp source into the mills. And there is a lot of political motion, but it's still not busting through. But across the spectrum, conservatives, liberals, libertarians that are seriously addressing reintroducing hemp as a bringing it back as another source of fiber. I'm just wondering how realistically, I mean, are there other countries like China, Russia, they're able to grow hemp, but can we realistically replace or at least offset our forests by growing an annual crop of hemp?
I think there's a lot of attention. Not any time in the near future.
No,
we're way too tugged into conifer biomass here in this region.
But if your question is if it was legally accessible and if it could get done, would it reduce?
Right.
It absolutely it would absolutely reduce the mm-hmm. fiber that's needed from trees. It would certainly augment it.
If anybody can, I don't know if anyone heard Wyden's speech on the House floor. He was extremely passionate about it. There's a lot of politicians that are really behind it, and it's just a matter of time, really soon. It sounds like there's some motion around it again. If we could put emphasis on that as being a solution to weaning ourselves off of our forests, I think that would be a good strategy to go with.
This is Rachel.
It's definitely a piece of the puzzle.
I think that would be, you know, the requirements for land and water and, you know, soil nutrients that would be required to do that on a scale enough to replace trees. The thing is, trees produce a lot of wood, you know, per unit of land compared to other crops.
You're talking about decades for trees.
Well, you know, they're talking fast rotation trees now that they can cut in 3 years. It's almost on the verge of being a crop in some places.
Is that there's consumption. When the consumption keeps going up, we're not going to have some magic plant. I do think that hemp can probably provide a good percentage of our other products. It's also a great food source as well, which probably might be even more important than its other uses. And then it also does tie into the ag industry also wants to burn anything, so been very, you know, we got to be careful about that. All of a sudden they could start burning hemp for energy, and a lot of us are not sold on the whole combustion technology. But personally, I do think that hemp is a worthwhile thing to move forward. I do think that some of the politicians support it because it's an easy thing that they know won't necessarily move forward quickly because it's a federal issue, even when the states do it. But there are active campaigns for that right now, and I personally do support them.
It's like the 60,000-pound elephant in the room. We all like an easy solution like hemp and biomass, but it's obviously not going to fly.
Hey, I have a question. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Gretchen here. So it seems to me that, first the question is about the argument that Greg brought up that when we put in environmental regulations, that forces, I know it's a smokescreen, but it forces or leads the companies to go overseas where there are less stringent environmental controls. And to me, that's it's just a convenient excuse, but it's an argument that people take seriously. And so I'd like to get some comments on that. And then the second is, then we're talking about the whole, like, burning anything, and it seems like the questions we need to also put out there, I think it'd be useful to have a charts of like the returned, the ROI, the returned energy on investment, and you know some of these like overview sort of things that like, you know, how much energy do you really get out of hemp versus coal versus, you know, whatever, so people can really see that and also see the entire life cycle costs in terms of environmental damage and so on. And I think that would be useful if we could, you know, do a concerted effort to get somebody to put together some materials like that that we can, that are understandable and accessible to the public. So I wanted to get your feedback on both of those.
This is Rachel. If I can just chime in and say that, you know, your first point about environmental laws that basically push the demand elsewhere, BioFuel Watch recently did a collaboration with the World Rainforest Movement looking at the expansion of the Suzana Papel Cellulose, the Brazilian big pulp producer in Brazil, that had signed a memorandum of understanding with a UK or maybe it's European-wide MGT Power that wanted to be, they wanted eucalyptus chips, basically, you know, cheap eucalyptus chips to burn in this European facility. And the lands there that this Suzana Papel, you know, has been working on were basically stolen from people who were living there in the first place. And the, you know, conditions, the living conditions around these plantations, which are there already for pulp and paper, and they wanted to expand them now for to supply the European biomass demand. You know, so I just refer you to go and check out our new report called The Chain of Destruction, which looks at that. And, the, you know, the other point about that is that while MGT Power had made this memorandum of understanding with this Brazilian company, they ended up canceling, and yet the impacts on the people that live there occurred nonetheless, because just the hype and the idea that there was going to be this market for all these eucalyptus plantations caused the company to start claiming more land and planting more eucalyptus in expectation of this market, which then got canceled. So it's really, you know, it never even happened, and yet the consequences for the people did happen. So I do think that the issue of how, you know, how things happen, this sort of domino effect around the globe is definitely something really, I mean, obviously we've seen how the pulp industry has moved around depending
on. So we need to encapsulate it so people can access it.
Yeah. So.
And then what about, go ahead.
This is Roy here. I've got to jump out to get ready for a holiday party. What fun! But I would say that as human beings, it's natural for us to be concerned with our own backyards first. That's a hard one to get out of. I mean, you realize you're going to shift impact or damage somewhere else, and that's for sure. There's no question about that. But it's difficult when you live here in Temper Central and you're watching the rate of cut go up and go up and go up and you're watching the fisheries drop. It's difficult for me as a human to get too far beyond that. It's just my natural inclination is to protect my own yard first.
Mm-hmm. Roy, are you going to be doing a panel discussion at the Environmental Law Conference?
No, I'm going to do the hike where I take the young attorneys up to the woods for the afternoon.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate
best
you.
Best duty at the law conference, let me assure you.
Well, thanks for making it on the call, Roy. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Greg, good to hear you talking again.
Hey, you too, Roy. Always appreciate it.
Yep.
Folks, we can stick on the call if anyone else has any more questions or discussion.
Hey, just kind of, you know, with what Ray said, and I think that is a part that's really difficult is, you know, we all want, I think, you know, we want improvements. We all want to reduce pollution and reduce carbon emissions and different things. Sometimes we can get focused on things that I think end up causing worse problems. quick example, you're probably all familiar with the black liquor tax and the tax breaks that were given. International Paper in 2 years received $3 billion in tax credits, which was a scam, claiming
which
to
they're
keep
making profit from.
Which, that's right, and which was a scam job, which they claim kept the U.S. industry afloat. While they did that, they did a $4 billion investment in Indonesia, $2 billion investment in Russia, bought 15 mills in China. It's this expansion of movement to cheap labor with very little laws. Environmental laws are part of it, labor laws. And for us as an organization, it's a tough deal when you're dealing with, you know, back to the log export issue, you're dealing with private lands, which is tough, right? Because we also support private land rights in a lot of ways. But when out of Longview, Washington, right now, log exports are at record highs, and the unemployment rate is at record high, and that's where Weyerhaeuser was based out of. And one of the areas we try to impact, when Roy mentioned Newport, which, you know, he and I were down there, here we give tax dollars to build a port to subsidize companies that want to export our raw materials. And so, again, for us, one of the main root causes does go back to the trade agreements that set up these processes to where we're no longer exporting a lot of manufactured goods, or even if we weren't even exporting manufacturing goods, but at least buying more goods that are made here under the cleanest conditions we can have, the best conditions, to make an overall improvement on the environment. And yet we subsidize these companies to build export terminals and everything else where they're sending off our raw materials and our jobs.
Well, my question is, why haven't I heard your name before or your position before?
Well, I suspect same reason I haven't heard a lot of yours. It's
well, no, I'm just saying.
No, I don't know.
Totally when, profound and beautiful explanation of what's happening, and just like you need to be heard more.
Well, we try. We formed an organization called the PPRC, Pulp and Paper Resource Council, 20 years ago. And we lobby trying to get best practices on environmental
separation.
And exactly. And so it's hard to get a common sense message out. I'll give you a quick example. Portland, Oregon, as I said, recovered city waste, right? 70% of the U.S. recovered waste paper is exported.
Yeah.
Pardon my French, but that pisses me off.
Yeah,
and if most people in Portland knew and understood that, I think we would start to see trade policies and economic policies change. That doesn't happen.
It's the part where we got to do messaging better,
I agree,
and more aggressively. And like we had the Tennessee Valley Hardwood Association 20 years ago that like fought off the last round of chippers. And they said, no, you can't export our jobs.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
well, like Roy said, all of these deals are already made. I mean, they're under the radar. And by the time we learn about them, it's already in place.
The industry hates people like Roy and people like the Tennessee Valley Hardwood Association for coming out and exposing the fact we're exporting forest and jobs. As all the more reason for to become more vocal.
Right. So what about, the TPP is coming our way, really, it's right around the corner, and that's even more devastating.
And if I can mention, I don't know how many of you have seen, so the other senator from Oregon, Senator Merkley, just recently is introducing legislation in Congress that requires future trade agreements and all past trade agreements to go through a process of review, and there's labor issues, there's environmental issues, and there's wage standard issues. And so it sets forth a process to remove the economic advantage for outsourcing jobs and doing environmental damage elsewhere. And so I would ask all of you to track that with Oregon Senator Merkley, look at it and try to get
this to this community.
Yes, Samantha, do you have that or who?
No, just lay out the case from your perspective. Post this here and we'll post it elsewhere.
Has anybody actually seen any of the language in the TTP that's been proposed that's relevant to this? Because I know, I've seen a little bit of inputs that have come out of agriculture, for example, but I have not seen anything on forest or forestry.
Yeah, it just so happens myself, I'm speaking at a forum in Portland, Oregon this Saturday on the TPP with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and others. The TPP is being negotiated in secret.
Yeah,
with right, and so nothing's been released. There's been documents. Part of the documents have been secretly released, but not everything.
Yeah, including a review of the environmental impacts, which basically said there will be none.
Yeah.
So, can you do that for us?
Do what you say?
Post your position.
On
PPC. Get that info out on the list?
I think it would be great to try and sleuth out whatever inputs have gone into that.
I think it's a really important next step.
But it's kind of late in the process because I think the final stages of that agreement are, being signed on the dotted line pretty much as we speak.
Well, that's what we're facing. We're facing all these, laws that are in place. And we're scrambling. We're really fragmented of where and how to deal with all these, exponentially growing problems that are all around us. I also wanted to bring up, what do people think about making use of our invasive species, like especially Scotch broom, that is a plant that is full of oil? I've been dealing with renovating property, land that had been logged, and that plant will explode into flames green. And
What way are you talking about utilizing it?
I just think we have a tremendous amount of biomass out there, but we're not looking at other sources of biomass that actually could clean up our environment, for instance, all these invasive species, to have some financial incentive to try to get this under control.
Well, the problem with, of course, burning anything is the fact that you're burning it, the pollution. Other than that,
there's definitely
a lot of people would support pulling out invasives and whatnot, but what ends up happening, and this was in a report that was written by the National Wildlife Federation, they were talking about if a facility is created based on utilizing invasive species, et cetera, you're going to always require that to exist. So in a sense, it can be a motivation to just create a facility, and let's say you do pull out all the invasives, which may or may not be possible, let's say you do that, then you're still always going to need another fuel source. So many of us are making the point that we don't think it's a great idea to burn stuff. That being said, there's
no reason why there can't
be more manual labor to remove invasives.
Right. I'm thinking of as far as with the Scotch broom turning into a source of biodiesel. Because of the oil.
There's a possibility for small-scale farmers, et cetera, et cetera. How that would actually go about anytime, even with the timber industry trying to get people to do manual release of vegetation on their property, they don't want to – it costs money. Labor costs money when you can just spray herbicides. So that's a tough thing to get any industry to want to do.
Can I ask a question? I'm curious on do you guys work on or are you familiar with the cap and trade on the carbon emissions?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. I wasn't sure how much you're working on that. Is one of the things that we're working on and proposing to try to impact less exports of raw materials, logs, and other things, are actually a carbon fee, which is different than carbon cap and trade. We've been gaining headway in the West Coast with it, and on part of that, obviously, carbon fee is a carbon tax, would be required on all U.S. manufacturers and all companies that import products here, and that the tax from that would, part of it would be applied back to manufacturing industries to continually put in best practices and renovate facilities to continually drive their emissions down. that would have, you know, a very positive impact on the environment. And then, and part of that on whether it's logs or natural gas or anything else is that, and we're, and again, on the West Coast, what we've been trying to push for has been very tough. We haven't got it yet, is to have a tax on logs that are exported, what, on things that are considered raw materials, is to tax them higher, to try to change the financial incentive so that we keep those things here to produce products here in the cleanest way possible.
That sounds great. And there's actually some momentum around that?
We've gained in Oregon last year, legislation was proposed. You know, a lot of the stuff that takes 3, 4, 5 years to get legislation passed or longer. We are gaining on it in part because we're able to show log exports at record highs and jobs are at record lows. And so we're gaining some. And part of, you know, whether it's, to me, whether it's biomass, doesn't matter what it is, on things that make the environment bad, if we want to improve it, we have to continually push an economic incentive as part of it to stop whatever it is that is bad or entice whatever it is that is good, right?
Well, this wood slurry that Roy was talking about, I don't see how that can be practical at all economically to spend all that money and infrastructure and to... That sounds like an extremely expensive process.
Yeah, in fact, the company he talked about, I used to work for years ago. I'm not all that familiar with them wanting to do that. I suspect they believe it'll reduce labor costs and transportation costs, but who knows? I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been about an hour, and many of us could probably talk longer, but we should probably conclude things. Just want to thank all of our excellent guest speakers, Roy Keane, Public Interest Forester and Director of our Forest, Greg Powelson with Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and Rachel Smolfer with Biofuel Watch. Really appreciate all your perspective and the great discussion here. And this is really just the beginning of things. We're talking about information, messaging, strategy, all those pieces need to be incorporated as well. This is not an easy fight. This is a some people, to most people, it's an obscure topic. It's a complicated topic. I have had conversations with many journalists recently who basically told me they don't understand the issue. These have been journalists who are working on this issue for months and months trying to write an article, and they told me that they don't understand the issue. So I think it behooves us to try to simplify our message, to streamline our message. And the fact that this issue, the biomass issue, the larger issue, has so many different pieces that we can touch upon, is both a strength and a weakness. So I think if the more simplify our arguments, the more
now,
effective
Josh,
we can be.
You know, we can go with the forest versus jobs issue and kick ass. Seriously.
Well, Josh, thanks for the opportunity. I've got to get going myself, but I do appreciate, you know, the opportunity to talk with you all.
Absolutely, yes. Well, thanks again.
Yep, thank you.
Definitely. Yeah. Appreciate all the information. Thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And then just to finish up here, we have these national anti-biomass campaign calls the first Thursdays of every month, and the next call is January 2nd, and maybe we'll talk about jobs versus forests on that topic that was to be announced. And to get a notice of the future calls, you can email me, Josh Lossberg, at josh@energyjustice.net, and if you're subscribed to the Biomass Opponents email list, you are already getting this information. So thanks, everyone. And I'm going to conclude the recording right now.